Okay, we've been putting it off all day. Tom versus Kira.
Rollerpalooza challenge.
250 metres. Oh man, I'm going to sweat.
You are listening to Service Course by the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. The stories behind the bikes.
At the stars orders. 3, 2, 1, go! Go, 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 go! And it is the Rap Biker takes it on the line.
Service Course by the Cycling Podcast with Tom Wally and Kira McVitie.
Kira. What just happened?
We just did a rollerpalooza race.
Yep.
And I destroyed you.
So, by a second, that's over 250 metres a second. That's a big gap.
Well, what can I say? I work hard.
Okay, so you're top of the leaderboard as well. Top of the women's leaderboard.
I mean, woo.
Right, Kira, you know Rich and Lionel want us to do this new podcast, this new cycling tech podcast. Listen, I'm well up for it. Can't wait. What I thought is we should probably get together and do record some of it while we're doing a bit of a ride. So I was thinking, how are you fixed up on either the 11th, 12th, 14th or 17th of June? And maybe we can meet like somewhere. I think you're really far down south, aren't you? And I'm sort of up north. So maybe somewhere like right in the middle of England. Anyway, I'll leave it with you.
Hello, Tom. So we're meeting tomorrow for a bike ride. We're going to meet at Wymondon Windmill Tea Rooms, which is a great little spot. And then we're going to ride to Melton Mowbray for a pork pie. So what I'm thinking is that we will do some of the Rutland Cycle Classic route. I don't know if you've ever done it before, but there's some off-road sections and there's some great riding around there. So that was my thinking.
Kira, I'm leaving now. I warn you, I've discovered I've got a puncture this morning. So bring tyre levers. I don't seem to have any. It's a good start, isn't it?
Excuse me. Is the Windmill Cafe around here?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
About 400 yards.
Fantastic, thank you.
What's
that?
You're taking your bike in, are you?
Is it a bike shop as well, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
I didn't know that, no.
They do like custom made bikes.
Okay, brilliant.
Down there on the right hand side.
Fantastic, thanks very much.
So in true cycling podcast style, I think I should start the show by saying, where are we, Kira?
We are at Wymondon Windmill Tea Rooms, which is a bit of a mouthful to say, and it's near Oakham. It is part of the Rutland Cycle Classic Loop, and yeah, we're here to ride to Melton Mowbray and get a pork pie, or multiple pork pies, in fact.
Yeah, so I'm Tom Wally. That was Kira McVitie. You might remember Kira from the Espoir Diaries. You may have heard me on Explore. I pop up in my shed every now and again. Normally, I'm behind the scenes on the cycling podcast, but they've allowed me onto the mic for this. This is a new series. It's the first episode of Service Course. We are a cycling technology kit type show, but that doesn't mean we're going to be super nerdy. We are going to get nerdy occasionally, but we're all about the bike, basically, and the stories behind the bikes.
There will be a disclaimer before any nerdy things happen.
Yeah, they really will. So for this first episode, welcome to the show. For this first episode, like Kira said, we are in, we're near Melton Mowbray. We're doing the Wymondon Melton Mowbray Wymondon Classic, which basically, again, in true cycling podcast style, involves us going off the beaten track, digressing to get some food, basically a pork pie, and that's it. But in this first episode, what we've got coming up, so Kira and I went to the London Bike Show, which you're going to hear a little bit from in a second. We've also, the main part of this episode is going to be an interview with Mr. Rob Hales, one of the, you know, fine cyclist in his own right, rode for GB, rode in the Olympics, Commonwealth Games, been a world champion, and he's also a guy who likes to tinker with bikes, so a perfect guest for us on the first show. But like I said, yeah, me and Kira did go to the London Bike Show to try out some of the new tech, new kit. And this is what went down.
Right, Kira.
Yes, hello.
Where are we?
We are at the London XL, which if you've ever been, is quite difficult to find.
Yeah, but you had a struggle, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we're at the bike show. And yeah, we're just having a wander around.
What are you looking for at a bike show? You're a veteran of bike shows, aren't you?
I mean, I personally am usually looking for the free nibbles that they have, you know, Cliff Bar nibbles.
Cut up into small cubes.
Available. Yeah, I'm looking for that. I'm usually looking for the first point of coffee, but there is also lots of cool bike stuff, which is also good.
Here's a game you can play at this bike show. Okay. Spot whether someone's cyclist, triathlete, or mountain biker.
Ooh.
There's a guy directly in front of you. Describe him.
So, tall. Yeah. Got a Vans long sleeve t-shirt on.
That's a gimme, right?
Mountain biker, I'm going to go.
Easy, I'm not even going to ask him.
Yeah.
I've already done a few laps. You've just arrived. I've done a few laps already. Yeah. I'm going to tell you my highlights so far.
Okay.
There's a guy selling dog food. I don't know. I think he might be at the wrong place.
Well, people have dogs.
That is true.
We did the bike show, an outdoor show in Scotland. It's really good for us because healthy people have normally got dogs. Tails.com.
Tom, do you have a dog?
That's why we're here.
I've got three cats.
We will be doing cat food eventually.
My cats aren't athletes, I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
they're not athletes. Now, I know this is more about cycling tech, but this is impressive. This is effectively a turbo for swimming.
It is. This man is in basically kind of a 5 metre by 5 metre pool, and he's swimming away. And
he's not going anywhere.
He's not going anywhere. He's just still. He looks happy, though.
Kira, what are your bikes made of?
Carbon.
Only carbon?
I only do carbon, sorry.
Can I interest you in wood?
Yes, what particular type of wood?
Let's go and find out.
You are looking at the Cocomat wooden bike. White ash wood, sustainably sourced from America. Every tree makes 50 bikes. For every bike we sell, we plant a tree. So we're making forests. White ash is very strong, durable. We give you a lifetime guarantee on this bike, on the frame. You know, once a year, you can give it a sand and a varnish, and it looks all new.
So what's the experience of riding a wooden bike like?
Our slogan is Move on Nature. And the experience is a whole different experience to what a normal bike. It's comfortable, it's soft, it's got lovely momentum, and you somehow, I know it's a cliche, but you feel one with your environment, you know? It's an eye-turner.
I don't know about you, but I think we're in the hippie section of the bike show.
I feel like we've got real sustainable and, like, I don't know, I need some hemp right now.
Well, funny you should mention that.
One thing that CBD is good for is helping with any kind of aches, pains, that sort of thing.
Kira, do you know what CBD is?
Can you enlighten me, please? I have no clue.
Okay, here we go. All mammals have what's called an endocannabinoid system. This was only discovered in, you know, early 90s, so this is why it's quite a new thing. Now, our bodies like cannabinoids, which come from a cannabis plant. And what happens is when we take the cannabinoids from the plant and put them into our body, it wakes up our endocannabinoid system. Would you like to try some?
Yeah, I think I really need to. The proof is in the pudding.
What's the benefit to a cyclist then for this?
For a cyclist, there's many. There's post-exercise recovery it's really good for physically. It's really good for mind focus, especially our oils that you take orally. It kind of clears any mind fog, so great for getting your mind focused if you're doing any racing or anything. Calms the nerves.
I'm feeling pretty calm. I can't say whether it's the oils or not.
It'll hit you in a bit.
Tie-dye hoodie,
ooh.
Unshaved legs, tattoo.
Ooh. Mountain biker.
Mountain biker.
Yeah, mountain biker.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah, got
we
it.
Saw you. We saw you on mountain.
You could not be right.
The purest mountain biker I've seen. Look at him. Another protein cube.
Oh, yeah.
Kira,
that one's good.
Kira, have you got the munchies?
No.
So Ashmay, what is Ashmay?
Ashmay, we're cycling and cycling brand of the show here, but we are talking a lot about merino wool and about the sustainability merino wool of the show. We buried a merino jersey and a polyester jersey alongside each other and showed how much the merino jersey degrades over amount of time. So over 6 months, pretty much completely gone. So yeah, it's very good.
So you're all about sustainability then, that's your...
Yeah, that's the messaging of the show, yeah, about sustainability.
I think that's a big change, like, in terms of cycling events and cycling shows. Like, sustainability is more and more brands.
Yeah. Well, people care. People really care about the products they wear. And you should... Clothing is more about... It's not just a sweat rag. It's something you should cherish. Like, clothing, you should cherish your clothing. And so we really want to talk about how people... not only when you wear the jersey, how you cherish it, but at the end of it, where it goes, and how you're responsible for your clothing as well.
I've got to say, I've never really considered
throwing, like, obviously I've got loads and loads of old cycling jerseys, and I've never even thought about what happens to them when they get chucked away.
No, I mean, a lot of my old cycling kit, they have, you know, quite a few charities where they send them to Africa, or, you know, guys in prison who are, you know, trying to get out and cycle, basically. So, I mean, that's what I do with my kit. But in terms of sustainability, I think it's the way that the conventional clothing market is going, but also cycling is slowly coming around to that, because you see it already in, you know, high street brands. They're getting a lot more sustainably focused, so it's about time.
Yeah. So what do you think about cycling as a sport in terms of sustainability then?
It's becoming more in vogue, I suppose, at the moment, and so a lot more brands are doing it. We've been using merino wool now since we started, but we were using always from a performance perspective. Merino's a fantastic wicker of sweat and anti-smell, has great benefits, but we never really shouted about sustainability aspects. Not only when you're wearing a jersey you should love it more, but when it comes to the end of its life, you should dispose of it in the correct way, in the correct manner.
So that was the London Bike Show. Kira, have you come down off your CBD oil yet?
Yeah, just about. I mean, it's been quite a few months now of being in the clouds, but yeah, I'm down now.
To be honest, I mean, I don't know what you thought about the London Bike Show. That was my first sort of big bike show. In a way, I was a little bit disappointed because it didn't make me want to put my hand in my pocket that much. There wasn't that much new tech on offer.
Isn't that just because you're tight?
There is that. I mean, I do live in the north, so I am a little bit tighter. But yeah, what did you make of the show in general?
I think it's always a good sort of place to go to see. You know, I'm mainly interested in like the free food samples.
We heard that.
Yeah. So, you know, my motives are clear. But in terms of the bikes, you know, there's a lot of pretty bikes on show, and I think it's just generally a good day out. I mean, we definitely spent far too long there walking around. But yeah, it was a good, definitely worth going if you've never been to a bike show before.
Well, we're currently stopped on the side of the road. We've come about 3 or 4K. Conveniently, Kira's gears aren't working. You have charged them, right?
I have charged them, but I took my bike out of a bike bag yesterday and didn't assess the whole situation. And it appears that the flight attendant, or whoever, baggage handler, man or woman, has... I want to say an inappropriate word, absolutely battered my rear mech, and it is now ceasing to function.
Well, in sympathy, I'm riding in the same gear as Kira. I'm sticking to that.
Yeah.
But it's actually quite convenient that your gears aren't working, because while we're at the bike show, we spoke to Nick Allen from Canyon in the UK. And we spoke to him about the importance of bike shows like the London Bike Show to brands like Canyon. But we also talked to him about what the new trends in cycling might be. And charging devices was very much a part of that.
This is incredibly important. So because we're direct to market, we don't have the 300 bicycle shops that stock other brands. So for us, we have to be making even more of an effort to put bums on seats. We have to show people the product. We have to get people looking at our bicycles. We have to inspire people that they can have confidence. They can order it online from a German manufacturer and then ship it to them directly and have the support from us. So for us, this is crucially important. Probably 3 or 4 years ago, we did very, very few events in the UK. And then over the course of the last 3 years, we've gone from no events to 7 events to 15 events to 30 events last year. And we're going to try and do 30 events again this year. And you can see a huge return, because people just want to speak to us directly. They want to see the bikes in the flesh. They want to have a bit of advice about a size. And then they want to order a bike. And it's happened again today. So it's crazy, crazy busy. It's not necessarily about the show itself and how big the show is. You know, you've got a lot of manufacturers who aren't here. But for us, it's crucially important that we come to these bigger events, but also a load of our smaller demo events as well.
So we're a cycling tech podcast, and we're talking about innovation. Where do you see the next big innovation in bikes coming?
I think probably it's probably already on the horizon. It's been around with us for like the last 18 months, which is e-bikes for sure. I think e-bikes in mountain bikes is going to evolve. E-bikes in fitness bikes is going to evolve significantly. We're taking a very close interest. E-bikes in road is going to kind of gather some pace now. You're starting to see the first bikes. So I think it's a very exciting new wave of interest into cycling that's coming. And we just need to be super positioned so that we're really on top of what the next innovation is going to be and in how that cultural shift of cycling takes place.
What do you think e-bikes will do for the cycling community then? I mean, what would be the big impact of it?
It's going to bring a lot more people to cycling, because I think there's this, on one hand you can say e-bikes is just helping you ride a little bit easier, but I don't think that's the case. I think what you're going to find is people will ride for a lot longer. So in a way, it's going to get your metabolism and your heart moving. You're going to be out on your bike for 3 hours as opposed to 45 minutes. You know, in respect of tech, it's not just about the e-bike itself. I think you're going to see, and Canyon were a big advocate of this maybe 3 or 4 years ago even, of this whole kind of connectivity within the bike. On our latest Spectral mountain bike, we've got a little USB port, so you can charge your phone, for example, when you're out on the trails. So it's trying to find where just not the e-bike itself kind of takes precedent, but where that evolution of connectivity within the bike and becoming a complete package, that's where the true innovation is going to come, I think.
And to be honest, for me, I've got to say, as a development in cycling, that can't come soon enough, because I don't know about you, but the amount of bike rides I've had that have either been delayed or ruined by the fact that I've not charged my Garmin. And these days, you know, yeah. You get home from a ride and your Garmin will auto, or Wahoo or whatever, will automatically upload, so you forget to plug it in anyway. And then the next day, I mean, you know, you can't go on a bike ride without a computer.
Well, you could.
Yeah, it doesn't
you
work.
You'd just be labelled as insane.
Yeah, it ain't recording. So yes, yeah, so for me, a bike that sort of can charge my devices, even like just the ability to charge your phone. Because I mean, I don't know about you, but I when I'm out riding, I listen to a lot of podcasts as well, and occasionally it rinses the battery on your phone, and then the last thing you want to be is out in the middle of nowhere with no phone.
Especially if you've not downloaded your podcast beforehand and you're burning through 3G, 4G.
Exactly. So I'm into it. E-bikes though as well, I've never actually ridden an e-bike. I've only ever tried to follow one and been humiliated when I see someone on a hybrid who's dropping me on my commute. Have you had much experience with e-bikes?
I've ridden an e-mountain bike. I think it was at the Birmingham Bike Show a couple of years ago, And it was wicked fun. Sometimes you're just like holding on and like, oh, not expecting it to accelerate when it does. So, yeah, they're a really good laugh. But what I find amazing is, I don't know if I mentioned it at the bike show, but one of the first cycling clubs I was ever a part of, Rocky and Forest Wheelers, there's a guy who comes out on the club runs called Norman. And he's had like a knee operation. He's got like a specially adapted crank so that he can still get his knee all the way around. And he's now able to keep up with every weekend group ride because he's got an e-bike. So I think accessibility into cycling for the general person is, I think it's great.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
I can't believe I get to say this, but that is Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupting to tell you that this episode of Service Course by the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by Lacquer. I feel so legit. Lacquer is a community-driven bicycle insurer that's a game-changing concept to insure your bike and gear, in which you only share the true cost of damages and thefts with other members of the community.
I took up cycling properly about 8 years ago, as I had a reoccurring Achilles heel injury and it was stopping me from running. I jumped on an old bike that I'd bought back in 89 and rediscovered cycling and did rather well in some small league races, and I've really gone from strength to strength now. My name is Rick Newman. I'm a long-term fan of the Cycling Podcast and a Lacquer customer. I heard on the Cycling Podcast them speaking about cycling insurance and Lacquer. I didn't have any at the time, and about 3 months ago I took the plunge and took out some cycling insurance with Lacquer. Unfortunately, only 6 weeks having taken out the insurance, I came off my bike. Thankfully, I was okay, but my frame's damaged and I had to engage with Lacquer about it. I've got to say, it was absolutely fantastic. I got home, got cleaned up, immediately got onto Lacquer's website, started speaking to Jonathan in live chat. You got this sort of rapport going in the live chat, and, you know, it was just great. He understood. 2 days later, frame arrived. We put the bike together and I was able to do the ride that I was there for, which was fantastic. So I really, really highly recommend Lacquer to anyone that needs cycling insurance. The pricing structure is fantastic as well. As you know, it's you know, really good value.
Visit Lacquer, that's LAKA.co.uk.
Kira, I just remembered, I was out in Girona earlier in the year, and I was at the EF Education First training camp, and I spoke to a few of the riders out there, and I asked them about the piece of cycling technology that's had the biggest impact on them as riders. So I thought we'd just chuck it in the show.
I mean, it has to be the power meter. Hello, I'm TJ Van Garderen. You know, then that's just something that, you know, those numbers, they just don't lie. They keep you honest in training. They keep you, I don't know, just the data that you can gather from that. It's like it used to be heart rate or it used to be whatever, and all those numbers, you didn't really know how to quantify that. But with the power meter, that's, I think that's revolutionized the sport, really. I mean, it's not for everyone, but in terms of, I mean, it's just, it's crazy. Like, now they can calculate, like, okay, you have to be this weight and produce this much power, and that's what it takes to do XYZ, and those numbers don't lie. So it really just, it's been able to show people, like, okay, you can do it, you can't. I mean, it's not, it doesn't tell the entire story, but you can't get around what those numbers do tell you.
The biggest impact, the biggest thing, I don't know, but what I love, you said it already, is the Garmin. Yeah, that you can just navigate the route, and even when you know more or less the route, it's so easy to use. I am Sepp van Marke. I ride for EF Education First. In the race, I put it like 98% of the time, I put it on the maps, and you just see where the corners are coming, when crossroads will come, when climbs are coming, if you put it on the elevation and you swipe it back. So I use it all the time, because let's say 90% of the races we don't know the roads. Only if I go to Flanders, if I go to Roubaix, of course I know the road, but all the other times I don't know the road, and then you know exactly what comes, dangerous corners or not. And I think it's a big advantage for an individual rider, but also just for the whole team. If you want to set up an echelon, you know where to do it, because you know exactly when there's going to be a straight part after some corner.
What you need is like a little alarm that goes off on the Garmin to say echelon now, start, you know.
Yeah, that's what they call a sports director.
That was a nice little bike ride, Kira.
I'm absolutely soaked now, Tom.
Yeah, it is chucking it down. But we have arrived in Melton Mowbray, the home of the Melton Mowbray pork pie. That's the whole point, isn't it?
I'm quite excited. We're at the Ye Olde Pork Pie Shoppy. That's its actual name. Shop spelt S-H-O-P-P-E.
Traditional way.
Yeah.
Right, so what makes Melton Mowbray pork pie is that it is, obviously only handcrafted and made here in Melton. But what makes it different is that it is made in a fluted case, which is raised by hand. And it has a difference of spices and seasonings, mainly a lot of white pepper. So my name's Justin. We're here in Melton Mowbray in Dickson & Morris Pork Pie Shop. For me personally, I really like the top pork pies. Those ones in particular are really nice. You get the nice, especially the cranberry or the apple one, you get a nice combination of the sweet and the savoury.
Well, we're at the halfway point of the Wymondon Melton Classic. That's what I'm calling it. Wymondon Melton Mowbray Classic. Pork pie has been had.
Oh my god, the best pork pie I have ever had in my whole entire life. I'm not overselling it here. You're talking amazing, amazing pork pie with gooseberry chutney. Like, what even is a gooseberry?
Can you hear that, Kira?
Yeah, do you want to hear mine?
That's the sound of my back wheel. We've just been over, we're on our way back from Melton to Wymondon.
Do you want to listen to my bike?
Yeah, let's have a listen. Give me this. We've just done one of the, well, not even one of the sectors from the Cycle Classic.
No,
but
a gravel section.
Just a gravel section. And listen to this. That's Kira's back wheel. I think we've learned that I am definitely not cut out to race the Cycle Classic. You look pretty handy on there.
I mean, you know, it's just feeling the motion. I don't know what I'm doing.
Just the flow.
I'm just so in the flow that I don't even have words for it.
Kira, it's
6 o'clock on a Sunday morning and I'm supposed to be racing, but yet again I've had no sleep and I've woken up feeling ill. It's the joys of having a toddler. So that's it, I'm done. I'm finishing racing for good. I always had to stop this year, but that's it, I'm done. You can't talk me out of it, it's over. But I need something exciting to do, and I've seen all this marketing about gravel bikes, so I think that's what I'm going to get into. I'm going to get a gravel bike. Well, actually what I'm going to do, I'm going to convert my cyclocross bike into a gravel bike, which I think just involves changing the tyres. But that's it, I'm getting into gravel biking, and I thought, do you know what? It'd be great for a service course if we did a little thing about the technology of gravel bikes. So I think you should go and find yourself a gravel bike. What do you reckon?
Will you also be growing a beard and getting some aviator sunglasses? No? No?
I'd like to say yes to that, Kira, but I've never been able to actually grow a proper beard. I can grow like a chin one that makes me look like I'm in Limp Bizkit, but that's a bit lame. The aviators, yeah, I'll do that. I'll get them.
So before we go back and clean our bikes up, one of the things we want to do on this show is speak to people who are involved in all the technical aspects of cycling. So that's designers, mechanics, manufacturers, frame builders, people like that. And at the same time, we want to speak to riders and learn more about their careers through the bikes they've ridden. That's why Rob Hales is an ideal first guest on this show. Not only was he a very successful rider on the track, but he also raced on the road. He did Paris-Roubaix 3 times. He never quite finished, but he'll tell you more about that. He was also part of the Secret Squirrel Club that aimed to ensure that Team GB riders had the best and most effective equipment for their assault on the Olympic Games. And they were pretty successful with that, I think we can say. Rob also works with individual riders and teams repairing and modifying carbon frames in his workshop in the Peak District, which is conveniently just one hill away from where I live. So I popped over to see him.
Where are we then, Rob?
We're in a man cave. This is my workshop where I do carbon repairs, wheels, frames, forks, for you name it, WRC rear wings for World Rally cars, anything that I can get in here. It's basically a posh shed. I've got my lathe in here, I've got my pillar drill, so I do my jewellery because I do key rings, the odd watch, and rings, which is my big thing, wedding rings and stuff like that. I've got a wedding ring going out this morning, actually. Got my grinders, my buffers. It's... oh. I'm in my happy place right now.
So it is this is a great place to be. I love coming up here because of the view is incredible, isn't it, up here?
I struggle to get work done now and again, especially on a day like this. Yeah, we look straight out over 20 trees and Kinder Scout, which is the biggest plateau here in the Peak District. And it's right in my back garden. So it's happy days all round, especially on a day like this.
Well, when you finish drilling, let's go and get coffee.
There you go, yeah, coffee.
So, Rob... long career in cycling. Take us back. What was the first bike that you really coveted?
Oh, blimey. It was a Colnago. I was on borrowed bikes because it was all the track bikes that we used to have that my dad used to have and look after down at Portsmouth Track at Alexander Park. And then I was on an old road tracks from... it was actually my dad's best man's bike that he used to ride on. So it was, I think it was a 5-speed blue. And then it came time, I needed to get my own bike to race on. And I was looking at buying a rally, actually.
So what age were you around this time then?
Blimey. Well, this would have been schoolboy. So right. I was, mid-80s, we're talking. And there was a bike shop, Butler Cycles, which if you've never heard of Butler Cycles, it turned into quite a big company. Something along the lines of Wiggle.
Oh, wow.
It was a bike shop. Prior to Wiggle, yeah, it was amazing. A bike shop, Butler Cycles, and they used to do rally, and I was looking at them, but at the time they had a second-hand Colnago in, blue, white, and chrome. It was, to be honest, with all due respect to rally, it was a no-brainer. It was cheaper than the rally, and it came with a front mech and headset and all that stuff. So yeah, Colnago was my first.
So you're someone who's obviously spent a lot of time in bike shops from, I guess,
all you can remember from your whole life. You've been in bike shops. What was there, you know, going to those bike shops when you were a kid, what was there a piece of kit that you, that was maybe exotic that you always wanted?
Yeah, the local bike shops were good. But there was one in particular, Julie's Cycles. You know, I don't even know if it still exists. It was in Leicester. Of course, back then, the National Track Championships were in the summer, the full week at Leicester, Saffron Lane, the track, God rest its soul, was no longer there. But the bike shop, and it was something that we looked forward to going to. They must have stocked it to the hilt for that week, and it must have run them for the rest of the year. But I can remember seeing the disc wheels and just everything. Binder toe straps. I mean, we call them roof rack straps now for keeping bikes on roof racks. But at the time, they're like the Binder straps, and they had all the different styles and price range, things like that. It was proper going back.
I mean, I've always been a record collector, and it was, I mean, you know, there was sort of, in the old days, there was records that you couldn't get hold of. You know, they had to come in from abroad. And I guess it was back then, it was the same with cycling stuff. You had to get importers, you had to get people to find this stuff and bring it back to
totally,
you.
Yeah. Junior World Championships in 1991, Colorado Springs, 5 weeks as a junior. I was working at the time at Gale's Brewery. Again, that's no longer there. All these plumbies are showing me age now. But I had 5 weeks paid leave, I should say. And we were going into the bike shops in America, and there you were, the Trek bikes. I remember seeing the original Specialized tri-spoke, which was just like a matte black. I probably weighed a ton, but and the silver, they were a proper metallic, almost chrome Shimano with a carbon sole as well. The shoes, just dreamy stuff for a kid back then. It was it was lush. What a time to be alive.
So were you, I mean, obviously this is about cycling technology, and you are, you know, you're someone who's always in his workshop, love messing around with bikes, but were you always interested in the technical side of cycling? Did you always want to understand how bikes worked?
I did. They were quite simple back then. I haven't got a clue these days. DI2, I've had to look after bikes over the years with DI2. Unfortunately, there was never an issue with it. Had there been an issue, no chance. The Campag EPS stuff, and now you go on to the new SRAM stuff, which I was with Nick Craig a few weeks ago, who works for Scott on the mountain bike side, and he came back after being at the launch, and he was telling me about it. It wasn't even English to me. I did not understand. So, but back then it was block and tackle, inch pitch chains. Which I did race on as well, but it was all simple stuff: cables, levers, no problem. And I really got into it. It was part of my thing. I can remember back Saturday was my day. I did my ride, and then I come back and I'd strip my bike pretty much, chain off, clean it, and get it ready for the Sunday's race. And so I had to know how the bike worked. And yeah, it was down to me as well. It wasn't up to the mechanic. So if there was a problem with the bike, it was my fault.
It's interesting. I mean, are you quite different to other riders in that sense? I mean, are the riders that you've rode and raced with who just have no idea how the bikes work?
There are a lot of mechanically unsympathetic bike riders. Very highly paid pros. You see them when I'm commentating now, and you can just see them. They pull over to the side of the road so they have a wheel change. And just things like, if it's a rear wheel change, they might, if the mechanic's lucky, they'll put it into top gear, but then they'll stay over the bike. And I've seen them with a foot clipped in still while the poor mechanic is trying to get a back wheel out. It's like, guys, stand back. Just let the mechanic do his job. If it's a front wheel, okay, you can straddle the bike, give him a hand, unclip it, hold the bike up for him while he puts the front wheel in. But a rear wheel, things like that, and the way they change gears, Schleck gate with the chain gate with Schleck, things like that, they just a lot of them haven't got a clue. They really don't have a clue. And to be fair, like I say, with bikes these days, it is a mechanic's nightmare. It must be, because I wouldn't really understand. Because I'm away from it, I don't touch it. I do the carbon repairs in my workshop. I don't touch the mechanic side. The frames, and ordinarily the frames have to come stripped down already, because you start getting into the mechanic side of it these days, you're just opening a can of worms.
Any particular cycling Luddites that you remember riding with? Name and shame.
Wiggins is one of them. You see him, his chain comes off. He's not getting his hand dirty. He stands there. Meanwhile, the peloton's hurtling away up the road. Things like that.
That surprised me because he's always, he's so aero, all about the gains. You know, I thought he'd been quite mechanically minded.
No. Well, no, because he never did it. Because he was a fully fledged pro, even when he was a junior. So he's never had to do anything. People were around him, changing gears. For instance, you'd warm up, do a track session in the morning. You'd warm up, and then in first effort, you've got to change your gears. Brad'd sit back, and whether he couldn't do it, he didn't do it. And they created this monster then that when he was a multi-million pound bike rider for Team Sky or whoever, if he had a problem, he just couldn't do it. This is a mechanic's job, let them get on with it. So, but he's one of many. I'll tell you another one, Ed Clancy, I'm going to name and shame him at the moment. when we were riding for Halfords, and we had the Boardman bikes. Do you know, he kept his training bike in the garden. Apparently his motocross bike was in his kitchen. His training bike was out, couldn't give a monkeys about it. And of course, when does it let him down? Pre-Tour of Britain training camp, we were with Keith Lambert. We were out in the middle of nowhere, absolutely in the middle of nowhere. His rear gear cable ended up like a bird's nest. It went on him and we had to push him back. It broke and frayed. It was horrendous. Got to look after your bike, guys and girls. Look after your bike. It will look after you. Because if you don't, you will... And it won't pack up on you when you're wheeling it out of the garage to go on your ride. It will be when you're at the furthest point from home. No money, no phone, nothing. I'm telling you now.
This episode of Service Calls by the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by The Economist magazine. The Economist is about far more than economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science and technology, art, culture, the environment and sport. It helps readers prepare for what is going on in the world around them, sifting through the noise at a time when facts matter more than ever. It's been a trusted source of intelligence for over 170 years, and it's for the kind of person who never stops asking questions and wants to know why the world is the way it is. Tom, you had a copy of The Economist with you when we went out on the Wymondon Melton Mowbray Wymondon Classic.
Thanks for noticing. I thought having that under my arm would make me look intelligent. No, but it's honestly, in a time where, you know, I struggle with attention span because of, you know, the internet and stuff like that, it is actually great to have a printed magazine. An article that caught my eye in particular, actually, that might interest you. How often do you go to gigs, Kira?
Less than I would like, probably a few times a year.
I think being a cyclist does sort of hinder your gig going.
It definitely does,
but, yeah. It was actually more than an article, it was actually a book review that caught my eye. It was a review of Rockonomics by Alan Kruger, which is, I don't know if you ever read Freakonomics, but it's a similar sort of thing. And I moonlight a little bit because my other side of things, other than cycling, is I do work in the music business, sort of. I work in music radio and I've run a label as well. But what was interesting for me about it is, like I say, working in the music industry, I've seen a lot of changes over the years from in the way artists make money. You know, from it used to be all about record sales and now it's about live music more than ever. But there's a lot of questions I get asked about making money from the business of music that I cannot really answer, even though I've done it for 20 years. So, for instance, like how much artists actually make from getting played on the radio, getting paid for streaming. So it's really, really interesting. And also, the music business was kind of the first industry that had to really cope with digital disruption. I know you're a YouTuber, you're disrupting sort of film and TV in your own way. but music faced down those threats a long time before, and you know it was much more, had a much more difficult time than guess film and TV did. So that was what caught my eye this week.
The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. If you've never stopped asking questions, then get your free copy now. For a free print copy of The Economist, you can text CYCLING, all capitals, to 78070. That's a free print copy of The Economist if you text the word CYCLING to 78070.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks to Science in Sport. I wonder if my lack of form this year isn't just down to having a toddler, but down to the fact that I didn't restock on my Rapid Rego recovery drink. Do not make the same mistake I did. That stuff is great. Science in Sport are offering 25% off to listeners of Service Course by the Cycling Podcast. To take advantage of the offer and stock up on all your favourite bars, gels and drinks, just go to scienceinsport.com and at the checkout, enter the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. And this offer applies to all full price items. Now, you'll associate Rob Hales with Team GB in the track programme and all the success and technological innovation that's come out of that programme. But it might surprise you how lo-fi the Team GB approach was back in 1996.
The closest we had to team bikes were our own bikes, all sprayed the same colour.
See, this is interesting because obviously we see what Team GB has become now, and obviously you played a role.
It's no wonder we were pretty rubbish as a group. It was dog-eat-dog. It was horrendous. It was. We all had these blue bikes made for, painted up for Atlanta, and they were the same colour as the Côte d'Azur, as that blue. They were that Azure blue. So, of course, in a team pursuit, when you were under duress, 3K in, the bikes just disappeared from under you. They just blended into the background. It was shocking.
So were you all on different bikes then, riding that?
Yeah, we were all on our own kit, yeah.
Wow.
I probably had team wheels, but that was about it. I mean, I can remember hearing stories from before then where they had these really, really light Clement ones or whatever, silk tyres that were put on the wheels, and then they were taking them off at the end of competition. I mean, once they're on, and you rip them off, they're knackered, but shocking stories.
So what were you, obviously you're someone technically minded, what were you doing back then to sort of try and make a difference, to give yourself those gains that you could find?
Nothing.
Nothing there at
was,
all.
No, well, the thing was, back then, we didn't really understand it. I mean, I look back at photos of me riding in Cofidis, for instance, 2001, 2002, with big baggy jackets, and it's that old thing. If I knew then what I know now, and I'm sure it's moved on again, but yeah, the real gains that I looked at in terms of narrow handlebars, wearing a skin suit, for instance, this came 2008 after one and a half kind of Olympic cycles of doing stuff with Chris Boardman in the wind tunnel down at Southampton and the Secret Squirrel Club and all that, just learning and seeing the figures. Prior to that, it was completely different. Things like, I mean, even way back before I was riding, drilling out the old drillium, as they called it, the chain rings, chain sets, for instance, rear
necks. Just trying to make things light as possible.
Make things light, yeah. It was all about the weight and making things light. And then aerodynamics didn't really come into it until, even when Francesco Moser did stuff, and obviously Le Monde with his bringing the tri-bars in for the Tour de France and stuff like that. You kind of saw it, and you didn't really know about it. Didn't understand the full concept of it until much later on. And it's even now, you see the top teams. Shocking. I was commentating only last week in Tirreno on Team Time Trial. Trek Segafredo. Trek. They're quite a big budget team. Highly advanced in the bikes. You look at the positions on their bike. Oh, my God, they are shocking. And they did all right, actually. They did, I think they were fifth or sixth in the Team Time Trial. Something like that. Could do so much better. Wouldn't take much.
Just a bit of time in the winter.
Yeah, I might give him a nudge. To be honest, you wouldn't have to go into a wind tunnel. It's quite simple now. You look at the top teams. Just look at the top British amateurs, what they're doing.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. And it doesn't take much to get yourself into a position like that. I did some stuff with Ivan Basso for a year. Last year he tried to go for the tour. I think it was 2012. Positional stuff. Flew out to Italy. Did some position and some just real simple basic stuff. They didn't have a clue. You think this was liquid gas back then, and trying to get him, manipulate him into a position was a nightmare. He just didn't get it.
It's just because some riders just don't care about that sort of thing.
Their priorities.
You're someone who's fascinated by it.
Well, because I know the difference. I've physically seen the figures, and I can feel it. Some riders don't have the feel. I was spoken to back in 2000 Olympics by Uli, who was doing the SRM, the German And he was telling me about position because I was really high, but I was very powerful. It felt really good. And he's saying, yeah, but you can afford to lose power to be more aero. And I didn't get it at the time, so I didn't go with it. And hindsight, obviously, I would have taken a lot more attention to it. But there's just not the understanding. And it's starting to grow and people are getting it. But there's still a long way to go with it.
So, over the course of your career then, is there a bike that you were given or rode that you absolutely loathed? A bike that you really hated?
Yeah.
Go on, tell us about it.
Lightspeed Titanium.
You know I ride a Lightspeed Titanium.
I know you do, yeah. I know it's not why
you've told me about this before. So this was...
absolutely beautiful bike to ride.
Was this with a sort of tri-spoke front wheel?
No, they were banned back then from road racing. This would have been 2005, I think. Lightspeed, it's just Titanium in general. Lovely to ride. For training around here in a Peak District, it's superb. Soaks the bumps up, everything. But for me, especially in a bigger frame, to race on, nah. Absolutely diabolical. Horrendous.
I mean, I think you've mentioned that you could go around corners.
I was apologising to riders. Really? Going into a bend, picking my spot, seeing where I need to go into the bend, and I was coming out in a completely different place. If you hit a bit of a pothole or something, I mean, the wheels we were riding as well at the time, it was Lightspeed's own real design, I think. They really weren't designed very well. They didn't last very long anyway. I don't think that was their own brand kit. Absolutely shocking bike to ride. I would have loved one if you were touring, if you're travelling around. Titanium is brilliant. Throwing it in and out of a bike bag, you can't scratch the thing. But not to race on. Hideous. Absolutely. They do say never blame kit. It was appalling.
So did you do the Philadelphia Classic on that bike?
That was we were out there in America, yeah. And myself and Russ Downing as well. I mean, he was on a small one.
Was it quite a mixed peloton then? Someone titanium, someone carbon, someone aluminium in those days?
Yeah, depend. I mean, the aluminium one that we had for training never fitted me. Right. So I never even got... In fact, I knew it wouldn't fit me and I never even actually got to see it. So I never had a training bike that year. It was race and train on the same bike.
What about, so we talked about a bike that you absolutely hated. What about a bike that you had that you loved?
I think the best bike in the world, for me, still is the best bike in the world, which I did have one at home. It wasn't mine, actually, because they weren't allowed out the velodrome, was the UKSI bike. Okay, it's a track bike, but I had a road-going version. I had Cav's road-going version for the Olympics. Absolutely unbelievable, proper engineered piece of kit, and they, like I say, they're still going now.
So, what's the story behind that bike then?
It was a UK Sport engineered for. They were over engineered. They were basically designed, I think, for something like an 80 kilogram or 100 kilogram sprinter traveling at 100 km/h around the track, 80 km/h around the track. I forget the figures, but they were so over-engineered for what we needed for the individual and the team pursuit. Anyway, they were just you point it where you point it, it will go, and you stamp on the pedals, it will go straight. There's no wandering, waving about. I can remember we had the frame, but we didn't have the forks or the bars to start with. It was just the frame. And that was good. And then the day we had the forks and the bars put in, it was like swinging off an iron girder, not in terms of weight, but just the rigidity and the stiffness of it. And I can remember doing my first team pursuit change. I went up the banking, and normally you used to have to fight with the bike and really steer it. So I went up the banking, came back, completely missed a team, came off the inside of the track. I was like, okay, I've got to recalibrate here. And it's just a little flick of the hips. You just kind of lean on the bars a little bit, but it was all in the hips. Absolutely superb piece of kit. And the road-going one, which they built a couple for, Cav being one of them, I had to collect it. And it stayed in my bedroom for a couple of days before I took it back to the velodrome.
Did you not ride that one to the shops one time,
Rob? I might have done. Put some flat pedals on. I went to get some milk, and it had DI2, which there wasn't a lot of DI2 back then. And I can remember local bike shop just down the road from here, and there are a group of mountain bikers filling up their camelbacks and getting a few Mars bars and stuff mid ride, and I was in my jeans, rolled up jeans on this boat. It was way too small for me, obviously, but leant it against the shop, and I came out and they're filling up and looking. I was like, all right lads, how's it going? And you could see them kind of, what on earth is this? And of course I gave the front mech a few tweaks, because it was like that RoboCop, that zzz, zzz, zzz. Just did that for effect, and then rode off with a 2 pints of milk hanging over in a carton, hanging over the lever, and just rode off into the distance.
So I want to go. We said we'd talk about your time with sort of the secret Squirrel Club.
You can't even say it. It's now. Hard. Now you've said it, I have to kill you.
It's so hard. So this involvement with Team GB and this sort of innovation and the attempt to make essentially the most technically advanced team in the world, how did that start and how did your role with them start?
My role was basically tunnel rat. They needed somebody to spend time physically on the bike in the wind tunnel.
So you were essentially a mannequin?
Basically, yeah, because it's really time consuming. And they needed people of various sizes. Obviously, I was one of the bigger riders. So I did a lot of the stuff. And then now and again, they would get the individual riders in themselves to spend a session. But most of the work was done by either myself or Jason Queeley, who was really quite involved with it as well, on the sprint side mainly. And it came through that and then discussing different ideas. I certainly wasn't privy to a lot of the stuff. I was literally the tunnel rat, as we called it. But it was a really good insight into how things worked on a physical level. And like I say, a lot of people think that there's a big smokescreen with marginal gains, and that it's, I don't know, smoke and mirrors. I tell you, it's unbelievable the stuff that the physical side, the frame, not so much the design in terms of being aerodynamic. It was never really designed to be aero, because as much as manufacturers will tell you they've got the latest, most aero bike, it will save you this. That is smoke and mirrors. There's not a lot in it. But the actual way it was designed, engineered for the forces, was incredible. You couple that with the forks, the bars, and then the wheels was something that that we worked on. Not just the overall weight, but the distribution of the weight within the wheel made a massive difference. And then the biggest thing was the suit, the physical size of the body. And they've since moved on. We didn't do a lot of work on position, actually, ironically, because that's really important as well. But they've stepped up again with position on the bike, coupled with the suit, the helmet, and the bikes. And obviously that on the track is quite measurable. It becomes different then and difficult to measure that when you go out on the road, because generally you've got headwind on the track, or, well, no wind, but any wind is coming directly on you, very little bit of yaw throughout the banking, whereas you get out on the road and hardly ever do you have a 100% headwind. It's going from left to right all over the place. So then there's a lot more variables in that, but you can transfer a lot of what they've done over the years onto the road. We were looking at stuff. You've got the Australians looking at stuff. The Germans, they're coming back into it now, but they had the FES project going way back to 92 when Boardman was riding in Barcelona against Jens Lehmann. They've had a lot of stuff over the years. So it's not as simple, put it this way, it's not as simple as just turning up to a wind tunnel and doing stuff. There's a lot to it, and it can be like opening a can of worms, and you think, well, the more you know, the less you understand, kind of thing, and you've got to go back and back, and it's so time consuming, and that's one of the reasons why I was doing it.
I kind of imagine it as like this place where there's no such thing as a bad idea, and there's just ideas flying around all the time.
Oh, there are bad ideas, but...
Were there any things that you tried that just didn't work? Or
yeah, there were things where you think, this is going to be brilliant, this is going to make a massive difference, and it doesn't. And you think, oh, no. And then there are other things. You go, whoa, what's happened there? What have we done? And no one knows. It's like something, the figures have dropped. The drags dropped massively. What have we done? Don't know. And you have to kind of retrace your steps and go, what is it? What's happened here? So there's a lot of that to it.
Were there any sort of specific, weird, unexpected things that you tried, or just odd things?
No, things like... to the aero helmet, pointy aero helmet. I said, oh, let's turn it round, just see what I'd... Made no difference, made absolutely no difference. There were things that we were looking at that we spoke about that would take the eye off the ball of the competitors. So one of the things was, oh, let's put this big twist in the top tube, something that would be really obvious, that would make no gains, but no benefit, no harm in the figures either, but just something that people would go, oh, that's it. One of the things we did was the handlebars, the original aero bar, made absolutely no difference. And the next minute, the Germans turned up to a World Cup and they'd copied it. And they went up to Chris and went, hey, Chris, you know the handlebars, they do nothing. And he just went, yeah, I know. But they'd spent 6 months developing these handlebars that did nothing. We then did the phase two, which incorporated something else, which did make a difference. And that's the thing, it's not just one item. So you'll have someone will come out and go, we've got the latest aero handlebar. It ain't. Because it's not just about the bar, it's how it works in combination with right. other things. And that's the thing that we did, or that the guys did, was the overall package. It was there was a women's package, there was a men's package, they're all different. You take one item from that, you probably won't get a gain. It is the combination, it is quite literally the aggregation of marginal gains, which again, people don't believe. Fair enough, don't believe it. You just carry on doing what you're doing, because I can tell you, when it's all put together, it's massive. The difficulty now is the fact that you're trying to find smaller and smaller bits to add on to what we've done. So that's a real battle for the guys.
Wymondon Metal Mowbray Wymondon Classic is ended, and so is the first episode of Service Course.
Thanks for joining us, guys. My bike is now completely filthy, thanks to you lot, so see you next time.
Yeah, time to go and give the bikes a good clean. So thanks for joining us for episode one. Episode two will be with you about 4 or 5 weeks' time, probably after the Tour de France, just after the Tour de France, because obviously we're going to be very busy with the cycling podcast following the race around. Episode two will be on all things gravel. Kira, how are you kitted out for gravel?
I have a cyclocross bike that currently isn't at full capacity. It needs a little bit of tinkering from my end to get it to work. So I might be using that, but I'm going to see if I can borrow a gravel bike, like a proper specific gravel bike.
Okay, well, that's it. Any other business before we go?
Tom, you didn't wear aviators.
I didn't wear aviators, that's true. No, stick to the Oakleys. I've been Tom Wally, and thank you, Kira.
I've been Kira, always, since birth. Bye!
Do you want to do your traditional sign-off?
What is my traditional sign-off?
You know what your traditional sign-off is.
Boop, guys.
You've been listening to Service Course by the Cycling Podcast. Music in this episode was by Moscow Youth Cult, and you can check them out via the brilliant Hello Thor Records. And this episode was produced by me, Tom Wally.